Welcome to High Truths on Drugs and Addiction, where national experts bring you facts and answers. I'm your host, Dr. Ronit Lev, an emergency and addiction doctor who has served at the White House and still practices on the front lines. Right here on High Truths, you will learn from experts from around the globe and around all aspects of drugs and addiction. To grow this community of information and action, I hope you give us a five-star review. Come visit me on hightruths.com to learn more about the show or download a free prescription for naloxone. Carrying naloxone for drugs is like carrying an EpiPen for allergies. Today's episode is sponsored by Families Against Fentanyl. FAF is an organization set on attacking the supply chain of deadly illicit fentanyl. To learn more, visit familiesagainstfentanyl.org and sign their petition to declare illicit fentanyl a weapon of mass destruction. Hello again, High Truth listeners. Get ready for a chemical conversation. I'm your host, Dr. Ronit Lev. Chemical, as in drugs, are chemicals. Fentanyl, methamphetamine, cocaine, and THC. You too can become a meth cook, like in Breaking Bad, right in your own kitchen. In one pot or bottle, simply put anhydrous ammonia, pseudoephedrine tablets, water, and add a little lithium, and voila! Watch the chemical reaction, and you are left with a crystalline powder to smoke, snort, inject at your pleasure. But beware. This shake-and-bake method can explode into a giant fireball if oxygen enters the bottle. That explosion would surely damper the high. To learn more about the chemistry of drugs, I reached out to a doctor of chemistry, Dr. Donna Nelson. Dr. Donna Nelson is a professor of chemistry at the University of Oklahoma. She served as a science advisor to the AMC television show Breaking Bad. She was president of the American Chemical Society and has written over 200 research publications, received numerous awards, and did presentations for professional societies, radio, television, and other media outlets. She has been sought after by the New York Times, the Wall Street Journal, and to add to that esteemed collection, we are fortunate to have her on High Truths and Drugs and Addiction. To learn more about Dr. Donna Nelson, check out the High Truths show notes. Dr. Donna Nelson, welcome to High Truths.
Hi there. Nice to see you. Thank you so much for having me on your show. It's a great honor.
No, it's great to have you here. And I thought we were going to have a lot of fun learning chemistry. I was actually a chemistry major in high school. I don't want to say that because then I expected to know a lot of chemistry, which I don't. It was just a stepping stone for me to get into medical school. But it'd be fun to go back, because there's so much chemistry involved in drugs. And I think that'd be like fun to learn about again. And I thought I'd ask you at first about your background. Like, why did you choose to study chemistry?
Well, my father and grandfather were both MDs. And so originally I was thinking that I might become a doctor. They were MDs in a very small town. So my father had taken over my grandfather's practice, and I was thinking I might take over my father's practice. But when back then, you didn't declare that you were pre-med the day that you set foot on campus. You waited until you were a junior or whatever. And so when he heard me talking about declaring that I was pre-med, he said, "You don't want to do that." He said, "You're not serious." And I said, "Yeah, why not?" And he said, "Think about everything that I've had to do." I mean, like I said, we were in a small town. He was the only doctor in a very large region of Oklahoma, a large portion of this county. So if a woman was having a baby at 2 a.m., he had to get up and go deliver that baby, drive to her house and deliver her baby in that house. And so there were a number of strange things that I think would be regarded as strange now. Also, if we were out, if my family was out eating at a restaurant, we would think nothing of it if a person came up at our table while we were eating and said, Doc, you know, my back's been hurting me a lot. Can I just show you my back? You know, and you take a look at it in the restaurant, you know. Or if we were driving out to a restaurant and there was a wreck on the highway, he felt like it was his duty to pull over and assist any victims in the car and wait with them until the ambulance arrived.
Yeah.
And so he, that was our family's idea of what a good GP was. And he said, "Are you sure you want to do this?" And he gave me a lot more lecture. You know, you want to deal with people who are extremely intelligent. You want to have life choices later on. You want lifelong learning and these things. And so I thought about it and I decided, you know, you're right. I think that I'd rather be a professor. So.
So it wasn't because you're a girl, like girls in the don't become doctors. That's I heard that in my culture.
No. In my family, I was taught that women could do anything that men could do. I was exceedingly supported. It was the opposite for me.
Yeah, well, that's good to hear. But
And I
you
think that's a good
still.
thing for me because a chemistry department has a very difficult environment for women.
And I was going to ask you that. So you had a supportive family that got you to do that and be whatever you want to be, but you still, in your time, faced a glass ceiling.
Well, I think I broke through it, but
Yeah.
it was very difficult. And some of the things I've watched have been very difficult. My mentor in graduate school was fabulous. He supported women and he supported me. My mentor as a postdoc was fabulous. I didn't really experience any problems until I became a professor, where in a way, you're competing with other professors, competing for lab space, competing for graduate students, competing for equipment, internal funding. And so, very rapidly, it's learned that any time, you know, there's like one pie and you slice it up. And if it's possible to diminish another person's slice of the pie, then you get more. And so that part of it was really distasteful to me.
Doesn't sound collegial.
It was not. It was not. Men
Yeah.
helped other men. There would be things that I had no idea that anything was happening. And maybe I would find out about it in faculty meeting. Maybe not. So
Yeah. Wow.
it
But you were
was
able
difficult.
to do that and succeed. And then I
Yeah, and
think
let me just tell you that the trick is to look outside your department and, if necessary, outside your university to find colleagues who will interact with you. And you don't have to, one does not have to restrict herself to her department. She can look, just jump outside. You know, I always thought of it as go national. There's a whole world of people out there that you can use as colleagues to gain information from.
yeah, and it makes it better, and it's not, it's competing with those
Yes,
other colleagues as well.
absolutely.
And then you came up with this Nelson Diversity Survey, and I
Yes.
wonder if that had to do with the glass ceiling that you broke through.
Yes, that was why. And the other thing is, you may not know that I am Native American. And so there are very few Native Americans as chemistry faculty at R1 institutions, and even fewer female Native Americans. And they're in Oklahoma. When you're growing up, Oklahoma has a lot of Native Americans. You know, like 10% of our population is Native American in Oklahoma. So it's nothing in Oklahoma. It's nothing unusual. But nationally, it's very unusual. And so I could see this happening, and also for Blacks and Hispanics and Black women and Hispanic women especially. And the problem was that before I did those surveys, it wasn't quantified. We didn't even know the numbers. At that time, NSF was sort of housing the numbers. NSF had the numbers for the demographics for undergraduates and for graduates, for PhD recipients, for BS recipients and PhD recipients. But there was nothing on faculty. And so we didn't know how many there were. We didn't know, you know, what the progression rate was, the utilization, in other words, of women going from bachelor's degrees to PhDs to assistant professors, then associate professors and full professors. It just was not known. And so I realized that I could do these surveys. And the way that I did that was to identify and email every department chair of the top 100 chemistry departments and collect the faculty data, the demographic data from the department chairs. That way we knew that the data would be reliable. And as soon as I think the next department, the next discipline, I think it was chemical engineering. They contacted me and said, we want you to do for us what you did for chemistry. Because as I started publishing these data, people were shocked. There were so few minorities. And so I did that for chemical engineering. And then physics contacted me and said, we want you to do physics. And each time I would say, you can do this. You know, it's not hard. And they said, no, we want you to do it with exactly the same techniques. So the data will be comparable. And each discipline kept contacting me and I could see where they were going, you know. And so I just asked the students working with me, some undergraduate volunteers were with me, women and minorities, no less. And we just went in and we did this for all 15 disciplines that NSF had the top 100 rankings available for. So we just went ahead and did it.
Yeah. NSF is?
National Science Foundation.
There you go. So you went from, you know, breaking the ceiling as faculty and the Nelson Diversity Surveys, and then to show business, Breaking Bad and the Big Bang Theory. How did you do that and what was that like?
Well, I did more with Breaking Bad than with Big Bang Theory, quite honestly. I mean, I was on the show for Big Bang Theory a couple of times, or as they term it, inside Big Bang Theory, we visitors are known as Geek of the Week.
Yeah. That's fun.
Yeah, and I put that right on my resume. I thought that was hilarious. So that's what the you know, the actors and the stagehands and everything called us. But for Breaking Bad, I was with them for a longer time period. And that was fun. That was just fun. I mean, it was entertainment. I've given many, many, many talks on that. And many people in the audience are very concerned when they see something on the show that did not that was not realistic. Occasionally there would be something on the show that was not realistic, and they could not understand that it was fantasy. I mean, it's fiction.
Yeah.
And Vince Gilligan did a good job of getting the science right, but at times he needed a plot device or you know, a trademark, like when he made Walt Smith blue. On one of my set visits, he asked me, what do you think about making the meth blue? And I said, I wouldn't do it. And notice I didn't say, you shouldn't do it. I said, I wouldn't do it. And there's a big difference there, and I'll explain that in a minute. But he said, why not? And he said, why not? And I said, because meth is white. And he said, what if it's pure? And I said, then it'll be white. And he said, what if it's really pure? I said, then it will be really white. And he said, what if it's really, really, really pure? And I said, it will be really, really, really white. And so he went right ahead and made it blue. He needed a plot device. He needed a trademark for Walt Smith. And they were constantly concerned about getting picked up next season. Gotta get picked up next season, picked up next season.
Right.
And so if you're a science advisor, I was told by, I think, one of the stagehands or something early on that there was this lore, you know, story in Hollywood that you can't have a hit show and have a science advisor. And I said, why? And they said, because the science advisor will tell you, you can't do that, you can't do that, you can't do that, you can't do that. In other words, try to make a documentary out of their show. And so I caught on really fast. I needed to align my goals with theirs. And if they wanted something other than
blue meth,
other than perfect science, then I needed to just help them. And so that's what I did. I just helped them with whatever goal they had. I helped them achieve it.
Got it. So take us a little behind the scenes, because that, you know, Breaking Bad, Bryan Cranston, wow. That was, I remember when that came out, I just binge watched, like, that's all I did day and night until I got through all the seasons. It was such a well done show. But what was that like? What is it like behind the scenes, working with the actors and the writers, and maybe tell us a little bit more about the chemistry?
So they were very friendly. They were exceedingly friendly, got along very well. When there were lunch breaks, everybody just went out, you know, out back to the lunch car or to the tables and sat. And there would be times that I sat next to Bryan Cranston, you know, and we just chatted during lunch. I mean, they were very, very friendly. And so it was a really nice experience. I have to say, though, that the Hollywood experience is totally different than what it's like in science. And I can explain some of that. I mean, it is a totally different world.
Okay.
So, for example, the first time that I went to Burbank, and the first time I walked through the door, I had my business card out and I was handing it to the receptionist, and she just looked at it and looked, she didn't take it. She looked at it and looked back up at me and said, "Nobody uses business cards in Hollywood." So I put it back in my pocket and I said, "I'm sorry," because I was thinking, I'm going to fit in here. I really want this to be a success. And so the first time that I ever spoke to the writers, they asked me questions that I had never been asked before. They asked me things like, what makes a person become a scientist? What type of people are scientists? How does a chemist talk to people in a lab as opposed to how they talk to people outside a lab? How does a chemistry professor talk to a student versus how do they talk to someone else? And I thought those were really strange questions. I had never been asked questions like that. They caught me completely off guard. But I answered the best I could. I just kept thinking, I'm going to be helpful. I'm going to, you know, do whatever they want. And thinking about it later, I realized this was at the end of season one, and they were still doing character development for Walt and Jesse. And so they needed to know how they would speak to each other. They needed to know how they would interact with each other. And so, you know, I just answered all questions, even if I thought they were strange. Another time that I thought it was really very strange is I, as a chemist, was always thinking about, I want to be a good role model for the students. And so I never would discuss drug synthesis with them. I just would not discuss it because back then when I first became a professor, we were constantly being asked, do you know how to make cocaine? And I just, you know, I did not want to get into those discussions with the students. But the one of the first times that Breaking Bad asked me for assistance, they sent me an email, and they asked me how much meth could be made from 40 gallons of methylamine using the P2P method. And I looked at that, and I just thought that was hilarious because it violated our rules in so many different ways. Just that one sentence, for example, I would never discuss making drugs with any students. We use the gram metric system. We do not use pounds, and they wanted the answer in pounds. And in our labs, we use very tiny amounts. You know, add 2 drops of this to 3 drops of that. We certainly don't use large amounts, and I had never used 40 gallons of anything. And so I thought that was just hilarious. I laughed for a long time, but I got right back with them and I said, yep, I can do this. I can calculate this for you. And so I did. And so I started looking it up. And when I got to the last step, it was the reduction step, and I asked them, well, what method do you want to use to reduce this in this last step? And they said, well, we don't know. What are the methods that we can choose from? And it was like catalytic hydrogenation over platinum, catalytic hydrogenation over palladium, et cetera, et cetera. You know, there were like about 8 or 10 different methods. And the last method was a mercury amalgam, you know. And they said, well, let's use this last method. And the reason they wanted to use it is because it would be easy for the actors to say. And when I looked at that, I thought, you know, I've selected reagents based on purity, based on percent yield, based on safety, based on cost, based on how easy it is to use. But I've never selected a reagent based on how easy it is to say the reagent's name. And so that was a first for me. But like I said, it's a different world. And so I just said, okay. And so I looked it up and calculated it and got back with them. You know, there are a lot of stories like this where, like I said, Hollywood was a different world. It was just a different world than I was used to. But I was adjustable, I was flexible, and I had fun with it.
Awesome. So, cooking meth. So, you know, I could ask you too, but, and by the way, so you actually were Walter White's, you were his advisor, his chemist. That's a great.
A lot of people have that perception.
Yeah.
But Vince did something that was extremely intelligent. Very early on, he reached out to the DEA. He needed to know what he could put on television and what he couldn't. And so the DEA assisted with that side of it. I helped them with things like how do you pronounce the words, what do you put on the blackboard, you know, things like that. I would review some of the scripts, but I did not help them with the actual chemistry or the equipment. The DEA knew all of that, and they regulated that. And I thought that Vince was extremely intelligent for doing that. Because that meant that anytime anybody complained about what he was showing on television, he could just say, well, the DEA has approved this. Yeah. And so, you know, all of the complaints just went away.
That's awesome.
He's very smart.
As far as cooking meth, what can we disclose on this High Truth podcast? It's not that hard. You just go to Google and you find things, and people were definitely for a time making a lot of methamphetamines in their kitchens using Sudafed. You know, every once in a while you'd have like a blast or fire or explosion. We don't have that anymore. We've restricted the amount of Sudafed that you could buy, right? I could go and buy a whole bunch of opiates from the pharmacy, but if I buy, you know, two packs of Sudafed, ding, 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 at the grocery store, it'll sound an alarm and restrict it. What can you tell us about what's happening with methamphetamine, how it's being made at this time? And you just enlightened us that Walter White on Breaking Bad used the P2P method.
Well, he used different methods.
Okay.
They were wanting me to calculate. I joined at the end of season one, and he had already done other things during season one. A lot of the chemistry that people complain about was done during season one. A lot of the strange things, like when the bathtub fell through the ceiling and all of this, that was during season one. And so that wasn't during my time. So, you know, he used multiple different methods. So by the time I came along, he was using the P2P method.
Right. And how could we tell that by watching the show, or could we?
Well, when they put in the mercury aluminum reagents, when they added that, you would know that that's the route that they're using.
Okay.
You know, and he also talked about it.
Okay. And I'm wondering if we were like teaching the Mexican cartels now, hey, let's do this P2P method, because supposedly that is the method of choice now for the current methamphetamine that's coming across the border.
Yeah. So they're not going to learn much from Breaking Bad, because the DEA controlled what was shown on television. The goal was to not have the show be a cookbook for making meth. And so they blocked that. Critical steps were left out, or sometimes they would mix one synthetic method and another synthetic method. So, I mean, we're still making meth, but using different methods. And so there was just no way that by following what was shown on television that anybody could make meth. It just would not happen.
So let's talk about fentanyl, and maybe let's start with, how do you pronounce it right? Because you are, you know, that's what you did on Breaking Bad. Tell people how to pronounce things. So yeah. What are we doing wrong with the pronunciation of fentanyl?
You pronounced it correctly. Fentanyl.
Okay.
So it has actually two correct spellings, F-E-N-T-A-N-Y-L or N-I-L. Both are accepted, but you see the former much more. A lot of people, including President Biden, say fentanyl, and there is a compound that is fentanyl. The O-L suffix indicates it's an alcohol, and so it has an OH functional group on it, and that obviously is not fentanyl. And so when I first started realizing this, I was really disappointed, because I was thinking, oh my gosh, if we can't pronounce the name correctly, how are we going to conquer the problem? And you know, baby steps, got to at least get so that we can pronounce the name correctly. I think that there's not so much confusion about this mispronunciation, because the fentanyl, which is an alcohol and which does exist, isn't studied much at all. Not much is done with it. And so, you know, saying fentanyl, everybody just sort of says, yeah, and nods and goes on, because they know exactly what the person means, because the compound fentanyl isn't being researched much at all. I looked this up just to see, and there were like no reports for the last 15 years or something. You know, it's just not of interest. So that's a good thing.
That, you know, that is one thing of my chemistry degree that I do remember. When there's a all at the end of the word, it means an alcohol.
That's it. You got it. Methanol, ethanol, fentanyl.
Right.
Those are all alcohols, and that's not fentanyl, which is the problem compound, but is killing so many people.
So let's learn from a chemist about fentanyl. Illicit fentanyl versus the medical grade. How is that different from what I use in the hospital versus what's being sold illicitly on the street?
Well, it's going to differ in a number of ways. For one thing, it's impure. What's on the street? What is used in the hospital or what is obtained in the pharmacy is regulated by the DEA. And so it's safe. And the fentanyl that is out on the street, and I just lump it in with all street drugs. If a person goes out to purchase street drugs, it's like Russian roulette. They don't know what they're getting. There's no controls. There's no regulation. There's no protection from our government. It's just an illegal drug. And a person is taking a chance, and used to, it would be a chance that they might get sick. You know, they might have a really bad trip. But now they're taking a chance that they might die. So it's much worse now. It's much worse now. We don't know where it was made. We don't know who made it. We don't know the conditions under which it was made.
And the concentration, right? The concentration is very different.
Impure is an understatement. You have no idea what's in there. You don't know what they put in there.
Right. There's all sorts of other things, you know, mannitol or now the xylazines or all these other adulterants that come with illicit drugs that when you get it, medications from a pharmacy, there is real quality control where on the streets you don't have that.
Yeah, but the Food and Drug Administration will regulate a lot of this, or all of it, you know. And so the street drugs are not regulated.
All right. The other thing is in the hospital, I use fentanyl in a liquid form. Now I'm conscious of whether I'm saying the word fentanyl right.
Good. Good.
Good. But it's in liquid form versus powder or pills that's on the street.
Okay.
And I don't know if that's a thing. Is it liquid because it's so diluted, because it's nanograms we measure it versus, you know, that's, you know, the typical picture that DEA has is that this 2 grains of salt can kill you, right?
Yeah,
but yet when I use it in the hospital, it's not 2 grains of salt. It's, you know, a bottle of liquid and I take out, you know, 25-50 micrograms.
Yeah, it's dissolved and I've forgotten what it's dissolved in, but it's just dissolved. I mean, there are many solvents that will solvate fentanyl. And so, you know, I don't know exactly what you're using, but yeah, it's deadly.
Yeah. How do you make it? Is it easy? Is that something that somebody with a college chemistry degree can do? Is it as easy, like methamphetamine has, you know, reputation being easy to make? Even in my days in chemistry, it's like, oh, we could make that ourselves. What about fentanyl? Is it more complicated, as more steps?
So from what I understand, the number, cartels have been working on this and have gotten the steps down.
Obviously.
Yeah. And so they've reduced the number of steps to simplify the synthesis. And so it's much easier to make now. And I can't remember the exact synthesis. I looked at them, but every once in a while, you know, a new synthesis will come out to just make it easier. And so they've adopted that. And from what I understand, you have to understand, I've never made it. And so from what I understand, it's becoming a lot easier, sadly.
What about these precursors? We talk about, well, oh, all these precursors are coming. It used to be that fentanyl came from China and under Trump administration, visited China and said, you know, let's stop that. And they actually did. They stopped making and transporting fentanyl to the United States. But instead, they just started sending these precursors to Mexico and then and just teaching the cartels how to make the fentanyl. So yeah. What are these precursors?
Well, I don't know. I mean, I don't remember. But that is correct. This is what I hear, is that the precursors are made in China. They're shipped over to Mexico. And in Mexico, the compound is synthesized there. And then it's smuggled across the border.
All right. And then these precursors tend to be like common legal chemicals.
Well, I don't know if they're legal now or not. I mean, in the U.S., I don't think they would be legal. As soon as the U.S. identifies a compound as being just a step or two away from an illegal compound, they start watching that and regulating it as well.
But I was thinking that even if it is, you know, household products, it's the quantity. When you're starting seeing, you know, these hundreds of liters or gallons and vats and entire ships full of like what is in there, that should raise a red flag, even if it's a legal compound in going after these precursors.
Yeah, but let me just tell you an experience of mine. Like I said, I've never made any illegal drug, but I did use amines frequently in my research. And one of the things that I was doing one time, I remember, and I don't even remember which one of these compounds gave me the trouble, but it was I was using a ring compounds that contained a nitrogen atom. And so in which, you know, the nitrogen atom was one of the atoms in the ring. And so I was purchasing a series of these, you know, 4-membered ring, 5-membered ring, 6-membered ring, 7-membered ring, 8-membered ring. And one of them was a precursor. And I was only trying to purchase something like 5 mLs of it. I mean, it was a tiny amount. And I was just going to do some research. I was complexing it with some carbon nanotubes and taking NMRs of the complex molecules. And I had to fill out all sorts of paperwork to get that compound. And once again, we're talking it was a very simple compound and only something like 5 or 10 mLs, but I had to fill out a lot of paperwork to get it because the government had designated it as used in synthesizing some drug. And I don't even know what drug. I just knew that they said, you have to fill out all this paperwork. So I did.
Yeah. Interesting how we have that measure for your 5 mLs that you wanted to buy. And yet there's these containers of precursors going around the world and coming into our borders with no stopgaps. Interesting. What about carfentanil, the deadly cousin of fentanyl, if that's even a right analogy?
Yeah, it's about 100 times more deadly than fentanyl.
So. Is there something that tells you as a chemist that this is going to be more deadly? Like if you see another extra nitrogen attack, does that make it more deadly? Or is there anything like that that we can learn?
Not a firm rule, I don't think. But these things have been studied, and there are lists of them that show the structure and the potency of the compound. And so you can sort of compare, and it turns out that the activity, the potency of the fentanyl analog is impacted most when a substituent is attached at the end where the carbonyl is, at that end of the molecule, as opposed to the other end of the molecule. So it looks like, I mean, I would guess that end of the molecule that has the carbonyl on it is the part of the molecule that is fitting into the active site in the human being, in the human. And so now the other thing is, as far as I know, and I haven't made a great study of this, I've just sort of noticed it, I am unable to tell whether it's going to increase or decrease the activity of the fentanyl analog by putting a substituent on that end of the molecule. You know, it's something where you just have to put the substituent on it and see what the effect was. So putting a substituent on that end of the molecule can increase the potency, but it might decrease the potency. There's no hard and fast rule that I know of. No way to predict.
Interesting. So
there might be, but I don't know it.
Trial and error. So, and I guess we found that out about carfentanil the hard way, right? With people dying on it.
Except it has a valid use. I mean, it's used to sedate elephants and things, you know, large animals.
Right.
So it does have a valid use.
Not in humans, though.
No, not that I know of.
Yeah.
It's just too potent.
Yeah. And carfentanil was used in the Russian theater attack, but it wasn't, it had to be aerosolized, right? It just like taking a bunch of illicit pills that people are using on the street and like throwing it up in the air, or taking a baggie and throwing it up in the air.
I thought it was vaporized. I thought it was sent through the ventilation system.
Right, right. And that's a whole method in itself, right? That's a whole chemical way of
It was just sprayed, you know, out of the ventilation system. And I think that it killed more people than the Russians had planned.
Right.
They planned on going in and giving the antidotes to the people who were not the terrorists. But I think they waited too long. And so more people than were originally planned were killed. So, I mean, you know, it's just another warning about fentanyl. You know, one just has to be so careful with it.
Right. What about weapon of mass destruction? We both assist families against fentanyl in their mission to declare fentanyl a weapon of mass destruction. Does that make sense as a chemist?
Well, it does to me. You know, I think that we're going to have to, take any steps that we can, because right now there are just too many deaths. There are just too many deaths. I look at it and I think, wow, that has really gotten out of hand, because the number of deaths really skyrocketed from
over 300 a day. It's ridiculous.
Yeah. From 2013, where it was something like 3,000 per year, up to 2022, you know, what, 10 years later, when it's 73,000
right.
people.
Well, back in 2013, it was it wasn't fentanyl. It was when people were angry at the medical community for overprescribing opioids. And now, like, wouldn't it be nice if we were at those good old days of 2013 when doctors were overprescribing? Because right now we have much, you know, double the problem.
Yeah.
Any myth busting on fentanyl, like, can you touch it and die, or does it have to absorb into your body a different way?
I understand that touching it is not a problem, because there are people who have to use these fentanyl patches or whatever for pain medication. And so that is, solid fentanyl on the patch, or and people have told me that they have helped family members put the patches on, and they've actually touched the patch and it does not come through, you know, in their fingertips, so it does not impact them. So I don't know exactly how the patch works. You would know more about that than I do, I suspect.
Yeah, even with the patch, it has to be designed to have another chemical absorbent to get into your body, and it's designed in a way to have small amounts over a length period of time. It's not giving you all the drug bolus. It's controlled through that layer in the patch. But right, I touch fentanyl all day, and I'm not, you know, overdosing.
Yeah. So I think that's probably the biggest myth, that these people responding to emergencies are afraid that they're going to, you know, because they've been there and touched something that they're with their hands,
right?
They're going to die. And so,
right. Well, they say that, you know, those two, what's in conflict is we're saying these 2 grains of salt can kill you. And you open up a bag and it's like, well, that's way more than 2 grains of salt, but there's so many other impurities. That's not pure, you know, fentanyl. So if that gets in the air, that's not gonna kill you.
Yeah. What I understand is that if one has a cut, or if one gets it in their mouth or in their eyes or even in the ear or in the nose, that it can impact them. But just rubbing it on one's skin is not a problem.
Right. And you have to get that concentration. And you could, in general, what I tell law enforcement, if you see people like walking around without their masks and, you know, baggies, and that by the time it gets to law enforcement, that probably passed 100 hands. And those people, the people who overdose are the ones who ingested, snorted, you know, got it into their body in a big way, not the people from passing it around.
Yeah.
Versus, if you see a scene out of Breaking Bad where people are in their astronaut suits and gloves, and then I would, you know, then you could be, you know, worried about just regular contact. What do you know, or can you teach us about other type of drugs like the xylazines, the nitazines, anything else that we, you know, can learn about chemistry wise?
Well, the xylazines are used here in Oklahoma by people. They, unfortunately, because as you know, that creates huge ulcers on their skin. I mean, that's horrific looking. And the reason I say it's used here in Oklahoma is because those are typically used on horses, you know, large animals. And so people are getting hold of that drug because it was intended for, you know, horses, and Oklahoma has a lot of horses, a lot of cattle, and so it's used here in Oklahoma, and the people are getting that and taking that, and I that is just so insane to me. I mean, it just looks like torture looking at those ulcers, and these are large ulcers, you know, on their legs or develop on their stomach or whatever. And I mean, it has to be exceedingly painful. I cannot imagine somebody taking that, but they are apparently.
Well, the xylazine also has an like anesthetic component. So when you're in pain, you actually inject it into the wound to help with the pain. But then that makes your pain, you know, that makes your ulcer worse. So it's a perpetual problem. But that's the power of addiction. That's what addiction does when you are, you know, have a chronic relapsing brain disorder like that.
Okay.
So you've been president of the American Chemical Society, and you continue to host conferences, huge conferences, like, right, you know, thousands of people who attend that. What interest does the American Chemical Society have on fentanyl and illicit drugs? Is this something that is of interest to the American Chemical Society? Do illicit drug makers attend these conferences, or
I don't think the illicit drug makers would attend these conferences. I don't know. I mean, if they are, they don't reveal themselves to me.
Yeah.
But yes, the American Chemical Society is helping us by permitting us to have these symposia. And the way that I view these symposia is it brings together the community. So the people who are working on fentanyl in different aspects can get to know each other. And it can help us to solve this problem faster. And so we had a symposium at the National American Chemical Society in San Francisco last August. And we had a symposium at the Regional American Chemical Society in Oklahoma City in November. And then we just had, just a couple of weeks ago, had a symposium at the American Association for the Advancement of Science, the AAAS. And I might point out that during my career, I had many times applied to have a symposium at a AAAS meeting. And this was the first time that my submission was accepted for fentanyl.
And what is this meeting that you are excited about?
The AAAS, American Association for the Advancement of Science, their national meeting. And so, we had a symposium there, and this is one that Jim Rao spoke at also.
That's great. And so what happens at these meetings? I imagine, like you said, Geek of the Week, you got all these geeks talking about fentanyl, and I don't know if they talk about methamphetamine or marijuana or all the different Delta 8, 10 products and other nitazines that are happening. Is that kind of one of the focus of the meetings is talking about illicit drugs or therapeutic and other type of drugs?
Well, it might not be drugs at all. They might come and talk about the science that's involved in cars or in transportation or anything. I mean, this AAAS covers everything from sociology to political science to chemistry and biology. So it's not that specific. No, I don't think that I haven't been paying that much attention, but I have not seen a symposium based on just the detrimental effects of methamphetamine. I have not seen that. And so our symposium was a little bit different in that it was directed totally toward fentanyl, and I organized it. And the only reason that I did that is because I could see the death rates. The death rates had just skyrocketed so much, I thought that it was important to have it. And so we're still in the stage of trying to bring it to people's attention. I teach students, in organic chemistry classes here. Mm-hmm. And some of the students are aware of it because they've had friends or relatives die from experimenting with fentanyl, but others are not aware of it. And so, of course, what I tell the students, and these are students, many of them, might start experimenting with drugs. And so what I tell them is stay away from street drugs. It's like playing Russian roulette. Just stay away from street drugs. They're not regulated. You don't know what you're getting if you go out and purchase a street drug. And in Oklahoma, marijuana is legal now. But a person who takes medical marijuana might look at it and say, well, at my dispensary, it's really expensive. But this marijuana available on the street is really cheap. I'll just go buy what's on the street. But the problem is you don't know what you're getting. It can be sprayed with fentanyl,
Or synthetics or whatever else. Yeah.
You don't know what you're getting if you buy off the street.
You can't trust your drug dealer. Even Walter White, right?
Absolutely. So that's the main goal. That's the main message on that. To stay away from street drugs. Of course. I know that that's sort of equivalent to Nancy Reagan's just say no. But I'm hoping that it will catch some of the students who might just be starting out to experiment with it.
Right. So I think we've changed Nancy Reagan's just say no, N-O, to just say no, K-N-O-W. So you need to just really be aware. And I think the statistics is that 42% of Americans have some relative friend or know somebody personally in their circle who died of fentanyl. So,
yeah, and that's a sad way for our society to learn about fentanyl.
Right. Let me ask you my like final geek question. When I was like reading about you, it says that you're one of the things you're working on is SWCNT. I had no idea what that is, even with my chemistry major. Single walled carbon nanotube. No idea what that is. Are you able to explain that in a way that
that's that right.
I could understand.
Yeah, it was a Nobel Prize winning discovery, not for me, but the person that synthesized single walled carbon nanotubes. It was a fourth form of carbon, and I used to have a structure of it up there on my bureau up there, but I don't anymore. But it's it looks sort of like a roll of chicken wire, okay, where it's benzene rings, just a whole mass of benzene rings, and it's tubular, single wall carbon nano tubes. And so we were studying those to see if we could put substituents on them or if the compounds complexed on them and how the compound was impacted when it was complexed to the single wall carbon nanotube. And we measured that by using nuclear magnetic resonance, NMR. And so, we studied that for a while. I'm not doing that anymore. You know, I have migrated through different projects. And I guess I quit doing that about 10 years ago.
What is the usefulness of that?
Well, one that we saw was that there are certain compounds that can be very useful, be active in the body. And that activity could depend upon the steric effects of a substituent. And of course, we had tried different substituents, you know, the T-butyl group being a fairly large group and larger, and we tried putting a single wall carbon nanotube on that substituent and as a substituent on that molecule. And it did, it worked. I mean, it was really bulky, which is exactly what you would think. So there's a chance that it could be used, you know, in some pharmaceuticals, but I'm not doing that. I haven't done that.
What are you doing now?
Working on fentanyl.
What is your hopes on working on fentanyl?
Well, decrease the death rates. I'd like to see that. Also, teaching, organic chemistry teaching. You may have heard that a lot of people say, oh, organic chemistry is so horrible. Many times I've talked to people and they would say, I started out to be a doctor, but then I took organic chemistry. And so, so many people are discouraged by that. And so I decided that I really want to try to make this easier. So I think I finally did discover a way. And what I did is I gave the students, and this is large class teaching. I've had classes that are as large as 380 students in my undergraduate organic chemistry class. So that's a large class. It is like the opposite of tutoring. So how do you deliver the content to a class that large? And of course, you've got 380 students that are all different. They're not like stamped out by a cookie cutter. You know, these students are all different. They have different ways of learning. And so they have to find what's right for them. So what I did is I gave them three ways to learn the material. I created a bunch of films, and anybody can look on YouTube and see my films. I've got about 70 films up there that are my filmed lectures in organic chemistry. So they could go to that and watch those filmed lectures. Or They could read the textbook because not all students enjoy watching films. A lot do. Some of the students said, you know, I like reading the material. So not that many. Most of the students really enjoy watching videos now. So they can either watch the videos for class that day, or they can read. And I use the flip class technique. So they had to watch the video or read that section of the book before they came to class. So that's two ways that they could take in the material. And the third way was in class, I used this, what's called Socratic method. I would bring in many, many, many questions. These were multiple choice questions. And I would put the question up. And then we would sort of discuss it and debate it. And the students would have contests over who could answer fastest or, you know, and it was just fun. The students had fun in that class and they got to know each other as they were discussing this. So there were three different ways that the students could learn that material and they really enjoyed it. That was in Org 1. And so, about two-thirds of the way through the class, they were trying to prepare on taking Org 2. So this was a class of about 160 students. They signed a petition. The students signed a petition, about 100 students signed a petition, saying that they wanted me to teach all sections of Org 2 so that they could be certain to have me, so that because they liked having this option. They liked having the flexibility and trying to answer these questions in class was so much fun. I have to say, I think that was the most fun class I ever had also. I thought it was fun.
That's awesome.
It was a big success. I had searched my entire career for how to find a way to teach organic chemistry that the students would like. And I finally succeeded. And as a matter of fact, here is that petition. I've got it sitting right here. I mean, so many students signed. I've never heard of that happening before.
No, that's point. Awesome. That's really special.
I'm going to write an article about this.
Continuing loving what you do as a chemist after all these years and getting that wonderful feedback from a new generation. That's awesome.
Yeah.
What I remember from organic chemistry is at the end of the semester, you were giving some powder. It was the unknown and you had to solve the unknown. That was like your final exam. You had to figure out what this powder is, doing all the different little tricks that you learned throughout this semester.
Yeah, that's lab, of course.
Yeah. And so Dr. Donna Nelson, thank you so much. Thank you for working on the issue and problem in fentanyl that a chemist can do that. Anybody wants to learn organic chemistry, go to those YouTube videos. Yes, and learn that no matter where.
They can download it. When I have presented this at professional meetings, sometimes some of the instructors would say, can I use your videos in my class? And I said, yeah, absolutely. They're free. Nobody has to purchase them. They're available. People can use them if they want to.
And we're not Hollywood, but thank you for being our Geek of the Week here at High Truths on Drugs and Addiction.
Well, thank you. And one last thing. Anything that I've said, please remember, those are my opinions, and I don't represent the University of Oklahoma.
There we go. Said like an academician. Thank you for listening to High Truths on Drugs and Addiction, where you learn from experts from around the globe and around all aspects of drugs and addiction. This week's episode would not be possible without the generous support of our sponsor. A sincere and warm thank you to FAF, Families Against Fentanyl. Visit familiesagainstfentanyl.org to learn more. High Truths producer is Dave Rivas from Davey Boy Productions. I am your host, Dr. Ronit Lev. We hope we brought your day a little bit more High Truths.